Blog Talk Radio.
Come on, baby, make it hot. Ride the cop till you hit the spot. Come on, baby, make it hot.
Doing it doggy style. Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee-yo. Wow, 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 yippee-yo, yippee-yay, bow, wow, yippee-yo, yippee.
And welcome to a Wednesday in Ecoland.
Hello.
Hello. Naked summer.
Mm-hmm.
Kicking it off on an eco moon. Oh, this is a great week. The weather's good, no humidity.
Yeah.
Less hassles from the humans.
Uh-huh. Not the dogs, though.
There go the mammals.
Ugh.
As I pop open a caffeine-free cream soda.
I'm jealous.
There you go. So, now that Michael Phelps is out of the pool,
mm-hmm.
The Olympics can go back to being a political phony parade as we watch the American basketball team and the softball team just stomp on people. It's actually kind of sad. I don't really know. I haven't looked at the medal count yet, but we're than enough.
We have more. Well, last I looked, we had more overall medals, but not more gold medals.
Even with Phelps, we don't have more gold medals. The Chinese want more gold.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, their judging system is.
Yeah, you have to look at the. What do you call it? The gymnastics and the 8-year-old. Gymnasts from over there, but
I still haven't gotten past that whole thing. A perfect score is now like a 17 or something.
It's really wacky.
Yeah, and you know, how many people watch any gymnastics until there's Olympic gymnastics to even notice that this is happening? All I knew was that the girls kept falling on their ass, you know, for 2 or 3 days, and it's so sad because these people train. What about that one that hit the last hurdle the other day? The backstory on her?
Mm.
I mean, basically there were two of them in that race. I think the other one medaled too. That were like, you know, they had to like scrimp and save to train, and they went through all this horrible stuff. And I mean, it was and she's winning the race, and she's got basically like, you know, I think it was 19 meters to go to end the race, and she hits the last hurdle, and she ends up getting a bronze instead of a gold. And I mean, just. You felt really bad, but I'm saying to myself, it's like, it used to be, in track and field anyway, it used to be that it was Olympics and nothing, but they compete on all these international things. It always seems like a world record means nothing. It was like the lightning bolt guy, he's broken 2 world records in 1 Olympics. It's almost like when you look at some of these things, the first thing is you're just awestruck at how good they are. And then your first thing you say is, well, wonder if he's on any meds, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Especially these fast guys. I just never trust the track and field race. I never think it's fair. I always think somebody's on something. I don't know.
They test them, but who knows? All right, you want to know the overall medal standings?
Yeah, why not? Here on Naked Summer, we'll do a little medal count here.
All right. The USA has a total of 82, but only 26 gold. China has 79 with 45 gold. And then let's see, who's third? Russia has 45 total with 13 gold, and then Great Britain is behind that with 37 total and 16 gold. So the Chinese are blowing everyone away on the golds.
Yeah, well, that's kind of strange. I mean, does the host country just get to win more? Is that like a deal they make? Did they have a good Olympic team 4 years ago? Or I just don't know how that works.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's all like they're judging people. And it's like a... You might as well have, you know, the American Idol crew come over and judge the gymnastics. It might be good.
Mm.
And
mm-hmm.
Simon. I found it absolutely boring. It would be great, you know.
Mm.
Get some real judges over there. I mean, they're outright biased for some of these countries. I mean, forget about the age thing. I mean, I forget, was it the Russian? It used to be the Russian judge that would screw us. Now it's like the Chinese judges are screwing us. And it's just... To me, I don't know. I don't feel the... I remember watching the Olympics growing up, you know, 80 and the boycott Olympics, and then even 84 when the Russians boycotted us. And then what was the one that they bombed everything? Was it 96 in Atlanta?
Right. Well, you know what I think the problem is? anybody who's in the competition mm-hmm. cannot have their country being a judge. So when you have China and the USA and Great Britain and Russia in there, you have some of the more obscure and less experienced people doing the judging. So I think that really screws things up.
Yeah, I think the Olympics is, for the most part, it's about, the network that's hosting it and the people that are advertising on it and a handful of athletes that take advantage of it, and most of them are flotsam and jetsam. You never hear from them again. And who's going to care about the 20th player on the female softball team? I mean, it's just there's no, in a week or so they will just disappear, and we'll be looking politically as the campaign season heats up again with the conventions brewing. And I have no clue. And maybe this is something that we should probably ask our guest in a couple of minutes. What is the mindset of the Killer Monster as she gets on the plane for Denver and her Onto Brigade begins to circulate through Colorado? Because the Clintons are basically speaking three nights out of five, I think, at the convention. And now, of course, with the scandalous situation with Edwards, they're not even going to let his wife speak.
No. That's just messy.
Now, why is that? Why does the wife who's dying of cancer not get to speak at the convention? Because of what he did.
That's a good question.
It makes no sense.
She'll probably get too many questions that she shouldn't be needing to answer in public.
But Wilma, I just don't get why she is the one that has to be the one that's going to get scrutinized. She's there to advocate for everything that she's been talking about, the cancer research and the poverty stuff, and those are platform issues that anybody in that party would support. It just gets buried because of him.
Yeah.
That deserves a little costus.
Oh, I was just going to play that. You got it, or you want me to do it?
So we say to John Edwards and his picadillos. Mm-hmm. Sometimes.
Good riddance, fuckface.
There you go.
So long, you fetus-faced windbag. Good luck managing a Denny's douchebag.
There you go.
You know, every time I see him on the Olympics, that's all I hear in a loop.
It's on a loop.
Yeah.
It's on a loop. It's like me. I basically mute the TV, I watch him talking to Michael Phelps, and I hear that. So.
Yeah, I can't stop. It's an obsession, I think. I don't know.
It's gotten to the point now where I can't go a show without it, so I think we have to have a step, maybe a 12-step program.
For the Costas rant.
For the Costas rant, yes.
Oh, God. It's so good, though.
We'll go to CostasRantAnonymous.com, and we'll just play it ad nauseum.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
Well, maybe. Who knows? Maybe we'll get some listeners that way. 646-478-4847. And I actually did a show that actually has live listeners the other day, Mike Silva's New York Baseball Digest. It's a wacky situation. You know, I remember, this goes back before there was internet and stuff, but, growing up, there was like two types of sports fans in my milieu. There were the players, kids that played sports, and then there were the kids that collected stuff, all kinds of crap. Memorabilia. This is before it was even worth anything. Baseball cards, things like that. I would say Costas is one of those guys, And when you see what happened on this little Baseball Digest show with this whole situation with Mike and the Mad Dog, those listening under a rock here in New York, we had like a testosterone tragedy last Thursday night. I was actually coming back from seeing Tropic Thunder, whatever it's called, right?
Oh, that was... That's
laugh out loud funny. That is basically a mandatory viewing for everyone in this listening audience, because
that's right.
It is a domain tutorial that I might have to make some type of a DVD subtitle of someday.
Yeah, that and the other one that we saw.
What? Which one was that?
What the heck was it? Oh, Pineapple Express.
Yes. Oh, wow. See those things two days in a row and see if you can eat anything.
Yeah, we did that, the same week?
It was like within a couple of days of each other. Yeah, but there were some days in between there.
Yeah.
But I'm coming back from the shoe, I hear that Russo's leaving WFAN. You know, and they've been together 19 years. I mean, outside of I Love Lucy, what other, the Simpsons maybe is up there. How many shows last that long anymore on any medium? And here's these two, to me, maroons that are going to find out just how, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of the parts kind of a thing. Once they are completely split up. Now, Mike Francesa has only been alone for 3 days, and already the people that blog about the show on mikeandthemadblog.blogspot.com, give him a shout-out, are already saying things like, it's too boring when I'm listening today. Let us know if we missed anything. And they're the greatest fans of the show because there's no friction. If you just have an EXO by themselves, you just have an Onto by themselves, there's nothing to rub against. There's no friction. There's no spark. So you just have Russo has to go into this mad dog clown mode and just shout and scream and have these rants, which is exhausting for 5.5 hours to listen to. Of course, Mike has to sit there and talk about, he talk about the Pineapple Express is a guy that just names things, you know. And I'm watching Francesa today before I came over, and he's just trying to spark conversation in his own head because he's got nothing to play off of anymore. So he goes, yeah, beautiful grounds here. He was at a golf course, and he's like naming the types of grass and the trees, and he's naming the bird he saw. And he's,
oh, my God.
Fuck, what is this? I'm saying to myself, this is like a shadow of what the show used to be. This is what's going to be on the air every day. And, of course, Russo is going crazy. I just thought it was like you took apart what was a powerful polarity they had, and now you just got, you know, the positive and negative end and nothing juicy in between them. I hope that they perk up a little bit, but they haven't been apart very long yet, but it was interesting to hear these guys going on about, you know, the nuances of the show. And it goes back to that watching sports versus playing sports, two different things, and all the sort of the gossip column mentality that goes on around it is hilarious. It's very much like people that get, you know, caught up in Hollywood stuff or politics. It's like there's a backwash of pundits and people interpreting things. And So, you know, I just thought that was something that's sort of evolved with the media now. Because now you have the audience talking to each other instead of interacting with the host, about the host. It's very funny.
How long do you think it's going to take them to realize that they're going to need another player in there?
Well, they're both going to need, like, a lot of guests and stuff to play off of and stuff. But it's not the friction between the two of them is so visceral and so deep.
Mm-hmm.
You can't replace it with new guys. They have too much of a history. I mean, they can reference back to arguments they had 8, 10, 15 years ago.
Right.
And so it's like, you know, it's like an old married couple fighting. It's hilarious to watch. It's like watching the Costanzas on Seinfeld.
Seinfeld.
Yeah, same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right, I think I see our guest is saddled up with us here. So,
well, hold on. Let me get to the diving horn.
All right, then.
All right. And
you can go to the chat room. Open the damn chat room.
All right. I will open the chat room.
Someone open up a window.
Shut up. You.
I got that going to that, by the way. All right. So we're going to make some eye contact with Dr. Susan Lacombe from, I think it's Vancouver, British Columbia. We'll have to find out in a minute.
Yeah.
From myshrink.com. Going to join us here on Naked Soma. Hello, Suzanne.
Hi.
Greetings.
Good.
Well, I don't know if you heard our little diatribe there leading into your interview here, but we're wondering about a couple of things tonight that maybe you could set us straight on here. And for anyone that hasn't gone over to myshrink.com yet, I mean, I spend sometimes multiple sessions just trying to worm my way around through all the articles on there. It's great.
Great site.
I have the little gremlin thing toolbar you got going. It's great stuff.
Good.
You know, and one of the things I want to start off with is that much like the chiropractor SAPES that I roll with sometimes have to carry the burden of the quack quack around. You're a quack, you're a quack. The psychologists have to deal with the derogatory term shrink, and you have actually embraced that term. So why don't you give us a little background on why you chose that particular path?
Well, it's the best way to sort of embrace, you know, get through a fear is to embrace it and to start owning it. Like, it's the same thing in the gay community. You know, they started calling themselves queer. They used that word so that they could own it instead of it being thrown at them.
Uh-huh.
That same idea where you take it and you own it. So that's where that was coming from. And actually, the response was really positive. Right away, people were laughing and that kind of thing. So I knew I was onto something.
Well, that's what they call people when they say they go into the therapy sessions. I got to get going. I got to go to my shrinks.
Right.
I mean, that's
yeah.
what they say.
Yeah, exactly.
People say it. I mean, you know, I mean, this is something we got to realize. I guess the word is we're very jaded about the way therapy is presented in the mainstream and the way people use therapy even more so.
Yeah.
So why don't you give us your take on how you see. You know, because a lot of distinctions you make on the site about things like emotional health and things like that. So just give us your take on what you think the therapeutic environment really is when it comes to psychology.
Well, I guess, you know, the whole neuroscience, like
mm-hmm.
the last couple of decades, have really shed a lot of light on what actually is happening in therapy to create the change that's going on. So we're much more sort of finely tuned, let's say, in terms of understanding
mm-hmm.
how change occurs. And when you understand that the nervous system really is built on connection and it's built for survival, when you get those two ideas, then you can see sort of really huge implications for how therapy can be used for changing, like changing the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people think that therapy is about going and talking, let's say. Like, so you could go and talk with your friend. And so, you know, so why would I need a shrink? Because I can just use my friends and I'll talk to my friends and I'll, you know, vent, et cetera. But
many have called those friends bartenders, by the way.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. But there's a lot going on because you're developing a relationship that's boundaried in very specific ways. And so your nervous system learns that this is a safe place, so you have access to deeper emotions that you can, like if you're talking to a friend, we tend to talk over our stuff, we talk through it, so we don't really get into the depth of something, and that's where a therapist is sort of bringing that to our attention, and that's, we need that sort of presence, that moment, those moments in time to actually create the neural net firing in the brain so that it makes it possible for new connections to occur. And that's what change is all about, making new connections in the brain.
Now, what percentage of therapists do you think are that aware of that role that they're playing as far as the neuropsychology and dealing with things like shifting physiology? I think most therapists learn, just like most chiropractors, they learn a set of techniques that mm-hmm. some become... You know, Adler types, some become Jungian types, some become Gestalt
yeah.
types, and they just become procedural, and they don't have this
oh,
awareness.
Oh, that is so true. Like,
uh-huh.
and anyone can be procedural. Any therapist can,
mm-hmm.
even a really good therapist can become procedural in the way they relate. But therapists that are really tuned in to establishing a good relationship, it doesn't matter what technique they use, if they are tuned into the client, then they're using that as their guidepost to, and that's attunement is where you have that kind of firing that's necessary in the brain for those new connections.
Now, there's been a growing trend in psychology to deal with pediatric developmental aspects of this, where you take these kids that have either joined or been drafted into Ritalin Nation. And they're going to therapy.
Yeah.
Now, you're talking about a dialogue between two adults mostly is what I think you're referring to in the earlier part here. How does this apply to a six-year-old kid who's been put into the spectrum, as it were, and is facing an academic black hole and is maybe dealing with a dysfunctional family or at least a stressed-out family?
Yeah.
So how does that apply, your model apply there?
Well, even with two adults, like the therapist and client, two adults, it's not in the talking. It's in changing the implicit memory system, and that's all via experience. So So you're having an experience with your when you're a therapist, whether you're an adult or you're a six-year-old. So it's through experience that you're changing the brain.
Okay. So is that something that you think that the practicing pediatric psychologists out there are, again, are they, maybe they're aware of it, but are they applying it to any degree and extent, or are they just...
Well, they aren't. They're doing things like play therapy.
Yeah, I've seen some of that emerge. I still see a lot of labeling going on. I mean, especially
yeah,
when it comes
yeah,
to the
I
academic
know.
Environment.
Oh, I
well,
know.
You have to, otherwise you can't give them the services they need because stupid system we're in.
Yeah, Professor Val's venting here because of her experience
yeah.
and that.
Yeah.
And it just seems like, much like the chiropractors got rooked into a lot of insurance-based work, third-party work in the 80s when everybody had $100 deductibles and no limits to visitations, you get stuck into, okay, I have to diagnose you. You have to have something wrong with you before I can help you. But you're talking about a more proactive approach to therapy. And the other thing that's really emerged, and we talked about in some other interviews here, is the notion of instead of therapy being longitudinal, where someone stays with the same therapist for years and sometimes decades, if you're Woody Allen, and really no change is made because you have this professional kickstand around, is this notion of brief therapy where someone comes in and is basically given a strategy rather than a process. And so, again, if we're dealing with, and this is one of those little kind of word summer things, entrainment, where you're dealing with, it's not so much about what they're saying. It's much more about the state that they're occupying, that the therapist is occupying and holding for the client so that the client can match it. This is where I'm saying, I think this piece has been completely, I don't know, maybe you guys can settle it between here, but has there been any movement to train psychologists in reading and in transferring physiology, not just the verbal component?
Well, I would say that body psychotherapists are most aware in terms of physiology.
Right, but is that even in the training? Is that something that exists in the training of a psychologist?
I'm teaching body psychology? I'm teaching theories of counseling in September, and it's not in this book that I'm teaching from, but there are a few interesting things in here. Hey, Doc, have you heard of this one? Hold on, I got to just throw this out here. Multicultural feminist social justice movement.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
it's a new type of therapy.
Sounds like a protest.
Yeah, it does.
Well, I'll be teaching it, so I probably have to learn it real quick since it starts in a couple of weeks.
What is that about?
I don't know.
This is what I'm saying. The psychologist can be basically, and this is another thing, maybe up where you are, and is it British Columbia, by the way?
Yes, it is.
Is that where you're right? Okay.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Is the movement towards, like, some of the, we call it the woo, as opposed to the conventional, we call that the moo. And so the woo psychology has moved on to the quantum mode, and things like energy psychology has come up.
Right.
And with a very loose grip on the word energy, by the way.
Yeah.
And you discuss on your site there, one of the things that's right on your homepage now, you guys can click over to it on myshrink.com, is the subject of transference, which is a traditional psychology term. Everybody was scared of, the transference. It was like this big evil thing.
Oh, yeah.
And the Jungians were not allowed, you know. And so I've gone to, and I probably sat in rooms with more psychologists than chiropractors in the last 15 years, fascinated with you guys. Your maps are so, elaborate. And the guy was talking about archetypes and stuff like that and interpreting dreams. And the guy just had the chutzpah to volunteer that the client has the dream so that the therapist can interpret it for them. And I was,
wow.
I mean, I was like, well, yeah, exactly. I was sitting in the back of the room with about probably 100 people in the room, and I just said it like Kramer, drop the chalupa. I just said it and out loud, like, what did he just say? And of course, my wingman at the time, George, was there and buried the poor bastard. Yeah, but buried him. Basically, just how do you guys, on the therapeutic side of the coin, you guys go through a formal training. You learn how to get information. You learn how to deal with things that are triggers. And there's a structure to the session. I mean, it's not just, it's not just like a random conversation at a diner, like you were saying before. So how do you balance this sort of kind of formal technical thing with the fluid environment of a conversation if you have this role where you are, you're not ever on the client side of the mirror? Like, those experiences never happen to the therapist. The therapist is basically almost unseen, just like in the Freudian world where they don't even face you. So how do you guys reconcile the fact that, and maybe this is something why a lot of therapists are clinically depressed, that your role is sort of one directional, the way they set it up. They set it up so that it's all about the client's issues and problems and limitations. Yeah. The therapist doesn't exist.
Yeah.
How does that work in this neurophysiological model where there's mirror neurons and things talking and it's exchange, it's more back and forth?
The fact of the matter is that the clients are impacting the therapist also. And therapists, I don't think, are aware to, not that aware to, of that, of the, how large that is, how much that
mm-hmm.
impacts them. So they'll see, like, this is one of the comments on the, that I was, actually it was on the forum. Somebody was talking about therapists seeing 8 to 10 clients in a day. Like, and I just can't imagine that. I just cannot. Because you have to be emotionally available. And if you're emotionally available to 8 clients a day, I mean, where do you have a life at the end of the day to be with your partner? I mean,
yeah, your spleen falls out.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That's usually what happens to me.
But isn't that the setup in the talk therapy world that you literally, just like the guy in, I was thinking of the guy in MASH, you know.
Oh, yeah, Sydney, yeah.
Yeah, Sydney. You're just dealing with the most horrible, negative, shadowy part of humanity, like a cop almost, and people terrified of that part of themselves, and it's never about moving forward and having solutions and transcending it. It's all about going backwards all the time. I mean, you have a problem, they go, let's begin with your mother. What? You know, it just seems like they take the weakest part of the person, the most vulnerable part of the person, and then they stuck their nose in it.
No, I know. That's really outrageous when you think about it. No. The new that's where positive psychology comes in.
Yeah, right. That's another one we got to get to. Yeah, positive psychology.
But body psychotherapists are trained to titrate the session, so you're always balancing every conversation with something that's a resource for the client, because you're trying to keep the nervous system, the client's nervous system, within a window of tolerance. Because if you do that over time, then the individual comes away with a nervous system that's regulated, that can manage stress better. That can manage those emotions better. I mean, I've just seen amazing things with body psychotherapy, just amazing.
Hey, that's not in my book. I might have to pull that
right.
off the internet.
Wow. No, I've experienced, I've had it for several years. And just to address that point about going into the negative, like what I found, because I'm going to therapy, but I'm going to therapy to make my life bigger. Like, I'm not going because I'm trying to dig into the shadow parts of myself. I'm going because I want to step into my life. I want to make it bigger. So
mm-hmm.
I deal with those sort of emotional blocks that are holding me back. So, I mean, that's fabulous stuff.
And again, another thing that's been creeping in, we had somebody on a couple weeks ago talking about coaching and the coaching model and how it differentiates itself from the therapy model. And when we pressed him, there really wasn't that much of a difference except for the name on the shingle. The role he played as a life coach is not that much different than the role you would play as a psychotherapist, except that the therapist is looked at as the expert and the coach is looked at almost like as a mental librarian, as it were.
Or cheerleader.
Yeah, sort of like a coach. Like someone who's giving people instruction and direction, but not with the same authority that a clinician would have.
Right.
So it's not big circle, little circle. It's sort of same size circle, only my circle's prettier than yours, kind of a thing. And so what's the take on myshrink.com about life coaching versus therapy? Is there any difference, or are they people?
Because it's kind of. Like, you could have a coach that would be encouraging you in your therapy, for example.
Okay.
Okay.
Coach that encourages you in your therapy? Which time do you get to go? Okay. A coach that encourages you in therapy. And then what else?
Yeah. Like, that's just one of the many things. Like, your coach is there, and your coach could be helping helping you deal with this emotional issue, like encouraging you to deal with that issue in therapy, at the same time setting some business goals or setting
mm-hmm.
some lifestyle goals. But how it would be different is that the way I've seen most coaches, this is not all, is that it's sort of a pushing forward. And the irony is that change is often sitting back. And it's kind of like you have to be able to, like if for me to go forward in my life, I have to be able to sit back. I have to let this sort of arousal pattern that's associated with what I'm dealing with what I'm facing, let it to arise and to come to rest in my nervous system. And that, I'm not sure if I'm explaining it very well, but that creates the change right there. So it's a little
uh-huh.
different. Because you can get filled up. You can get filled up with a coach. You can get, charge at, I'm going to go do this, do that. And certainly behavior can change the brain. If you engage in a behavior long enough, you will change. That pathway will be stronger.
Well, they seem to have co-opted the idea of a personal trainer on the physical side. As opposed to having someone who's an orthopedist or someone who's going to do rehab with you, like a PT would. And again, it sounds like from your point of view that it might not be quite splitting hairs, but it seems like it's almost, in a way, it's almost like, can people really absorb that many different messages and that many different directions? It's like almost like a lot of chefs in the kitchen there, and how much help can somebody get? I mean, it just seems like I just find it funny. And then, with all this mentioning of the nervous system, it sounds like everybody's kind of winding their way back to the old chiropractic model a little bit, that the nervous system is the thing that is sort of filtering experience in and out, memory in and out.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
If we regulate our nervous systems, well, then maybe we have a better chance to communicate better. And
yep.
Chiropractors, of course, talk about spines instead of nerves. I don't understand that, but that's their own problem. But talking a little bit before, I kind of got up and got my old chiropractic little philosophy book here from 1927. So I'm going to just toss this out at you here. Just the chiropractic definition of clinical, okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Clinic is where immaterialism enters everything materialistic, where the very process of reasoning is admitted to be the method of procedure in elucidation. All right? That's from D.D. Palmer. Pretty heavy.
Yeah.
Pretty heavy, right? So
yeah.
He says, now this is his son, B.J. Palmer, interpreting that. He goes, in the clinic, you use the ideas and facts of the patient as being of value and encompass your personal deductions in connections therewith. You and the patient do these things together. In the laboratory, you're alone, except you have something to work with indirectly. So not only does the chiropractor recognize the cooperation of a patient in working upon the case, but the meaning of clinic or clinical goes further, and then his whole emphasis is on recognizing the intelligence that governs that person. And this is where you get into a little of the woo again, that immaterial stuff. And that's why I think the average person, when they think of the psyche, they think of something that has to be described to them by somebody else. So they learn a version of the story from their Freudian person or their Adler person or their Gestalt mm-hmm. person or their Jungian person, and they're getting different flavored pancakes to me.
Mm-hmm.
How do they how do they separate the map from the territory? You're talking about the territory. You're talking about their nervous system. How do they get out of this map thing?
You mean how do therapists that are from different
dialects? Yeah.
Right. How could they come together? Is that what you mean?
No. How do they get people? How do you get the client? Forget about the therapist. They're lost.
Right.
How do you get the client who's looking for mental health? Well, we're just looking for someone to understand them at this point because they've already exhausted the priest and the bartender. Now they're at the therapist.
Right.
How do they get to the point where they're showing up for a session, and they're knowing that they're working from the inside out rather than from the outside in? They're not working on the situation around them. They're working on their perception. To me, it's more of a biofeedback model that needs to be presented to them, just as simple as they do when they learn things mindful practices, things like meditation, things like that. How do you, like in somatics, we just say, we're not separating mind from body anymore.
Right.
That's stupid. We're saying it's organism and environment, because that's the macro, there's a macrosphere and a microsphere, and then there's this mesosphere, this middle layer where we live on. I always find it funny that the only time we can appreciate life in its generic sense, not so much living, but life, is when we stick our eye in a microscope or in a telescope. For some reason, when we look with the binoculars, nothing seems that attractive or that novel or that even mildly complex compared to what we see when you look at the cosmos or when you look at a petri dish. So how do you get people to understand that all that wiggling around that's going on in their body is something that they can move in rhythm with, like you said, work with the intelligence within that person and use the ideas that come up as sort of raw material, and then what the therapist's role is to refine that to them, much
right.
like when you bring, raw meat to the butcher.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Hmm.
Yep.
Now I went there, but okay.
Yeah, bringing the body into therapy is absolutely essential. I mean, if someday it'll be like it will be unethical, I think, not to draw attention to the body, not to bring clients. I mean, some clients can't go there yet. You know, you have to resource them back and forth through talking. But eventually they need, like, to make the changes you want. Like, that's how you get to the nonverbal the first 3 years of life. It's all nonverbal. It's all that memory is not in the hippocampus. It's in the, it's more in the implicit memory system. And the only way to really get at that is through the body. So,
well, funny you mention that.
Other than present day circumstances.
Yeah.
And things, yeah.
Well, because funny you mention that, because we had Stephen Hayes on here a couple months ago talking about his work in acceptance and commitment therapy.
Yeah.
He comes on the air. You've heard of him? You know Stephen? Great,
yeah,
great
yes,
guy.
Yes, I have. I took a look at his stuff, yeah.
Oh, great guy. And he comes on the air. He says, the first two things out of his mouth are basically people suffer and happiness is not normal, which is the complete opposite, by the way, of the positive psychology message. And it's just ironic because what he's trying to say is if you accept the system has checks and balances, you accept the imperfections, then you can modulate, you can adapt, and this is what, physiology is about. It's an adaptive process. And then when you compare that to some of the other models that are out there, I'll just toss a couple out there. What does your community think of something like EMDR as a modality?
Oh, it's kind of a mixed review, that kind
okay.
of thing. I haven't done it, but it sounds like it's beneficial for some people. Like
what about the ever popular EFT, emotional freedom technique?
Oh yeah, it's a handy tool.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Based
on acupuncture. Based on acupuncture, yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm tapping.
Acupuncture is great.
Yeah.
So.
And thought field therapy that it sprung from also is well received over there in the MyShrink world.
Well, I'm in a circle of friends and colleagues, and we embrace new ideas and try and get at the root of where
okay.
they come from and that kind of thing. So, I don't, I don't know any too much about thought field. I know it's some of my colleagues have used it.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, we had Mike LaFranner on a couple weeks ago from NLP community, and he actually trained me in NLP a million years ago. And he's doing things with live cell work where he's doing the same NLP procedures he was doing before, but now he's watching what's happening on a cellular basis in people's bloodstreams and using fancy biofeedback equipment to make almost externalize that microscopic world and say, hey, you're making physiological changes. Here they are. We work in our world, in our model, in universal somatics with heart rate variability because it's an obvious thing. So do you guys advocate a lot of...
Heart rate variability.
Yes.
Well,
yeah,
activation.
That's...
Your activation is the heart rate variability is a measure of your activation. And that's exactly what I work with all the time in
okay.
body psychotherapy.
Yeah, and this is another thing, like I said, I think this is where we're moving to,
yeah.
Hopefully in the world where I keep waiting for this Jetsons thing. We've kind of like separated the Flintstones and the Jetsons. As far as the low tech and the high tech models here in psychology, I'm dying the wool low tech in the way I work. As far as I want things to be as raw and as immediate as possible for somebody, and I'll teach them anything I have to, whether it's pulse points in acupuncture or whether it's how to anchor themselves or whatever it is they can do on the fly in a portable way. But when I want to work with them in a reflective way, then you need to work through the objective measures, and heart rate variability is the easiest one to show somebody.
Oh,
how
yeah.
subtle stuff is influencing their state. And, we had Steve Elliott on from coherence.com talking about that, about three, 4 months ago. And he actually has it down to, You breathe in for 6 seconds and you breathe out for 6 seconds. Not five, not seven.
5.88.
Yeah, exactly. It's something insane. He's extreme. He's an engineer. He's extremely exact.
And he's something.
He's great.
Well,
here's
something interesting. But if there's two things that we're talking about, there's old pathways that you can sort of, you can keep running through the old pathways and make them work better, let's say. But there may be people that don't have enough of those, enough pathways in the brain, that laying them down might be that it requires another nervous system for them to be laid down, the same way that the infant brain grows in the first 3 years of life through the interaction of the caretaker, usually the mom, that development is mirrored in the therapy session, like with another nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we're going.
Yeah, like I said, I think we're moving away from relying on the old kickstands of having the professional basically support the dysfunctional person in the one model. And the other one that we had a pretty lively discussion on a couple weeks ago with Dave Goodman, Dr. David Goodman from Newport Neuroscience Center, is the mass, he called it basically a mass lobotomy that's been going on the last 20 years or so since the introduction of Prozac and other drugs into the community. So what do you guys make of that, the role of medication in dealing with just simple, you know, the general things like anxiety, depression, things like that? Do you guys take a stance for or against it, or are you case by case, or how does it work?
Well, on the whole, this is not for everybody, but on the whole, it's been my impression, and I've talked to colleagues who felt similarly, is that in the work that we do, because I'm a body psychotherapist, I don't have the same range of affect, and therefore the nervous system doesn't learn. So my clients that are on meds learn slower, like their nervous system doesn't get regulated at the same pace as my clients that are not on meds.
I'm sure.
Now, somebody would say, well, the people that come in with meds are a different population. And that could be the case because this is just my impression. But I've worked, it sort of dampens things. So I don't have that same range to work with.
I hear the L word.
What's that?
Lobotomy.
Oh.
Yes. Or just in general, I mean, does someone that is popping pills, do they seek out the body psychotherapist? To me, they would seek out the couch.
Rarely do they come to me for body psychotherapy because they don't. It's not well known. And
right. Well, I mean, some of the chiropractors I know are doing body psychotherapy. They don't even know it.
Maybe.
You know, nobody's given them the permission to actually meet. I actually got in trouble. I get in trouble all the time, but I got in trouble at a research conference confronting a guy from the Rand Corporation, Ian Coulter. If you're listening, I'll be surprised. But this is in the wake of 9/11. And they did a 3-hour thing on ethics in chiropractic, right? Which is kind of an oxymoron. It's like teaching car salesman ethics. But it was like, you know, you had a couple hundred. And by the way, we're 2 blocks from Bourbon Street in New Orleans. Let's talk ethics. There's people with beads on in the audience. It's tremendous. And so he's admonishing us. And this guy has a PhD. He's not a chiropractor. He's a PhD in whatever, in yelling, I think. And he looked like the absent-minded professor up there, Irwin Corey, with the hair flying and all that. And he's taking questions from the crowd at the end. And the discussion was, do you deal with the spiritual well-being of a client? How do you deal with the spiritual well-being of a client without crossing over into religion, things like that? And he basically said, unless you have a degree in comparative religions, you should never discuss a spiritual concern of a client. You should immediately call... cofactor care, whatever you call it.
What
so
a
I
dope.
I said, we're leaving for the airport. It's the last day of the conference. And I said to the guy I went with, I said, oh, hell no. So I got up online to ask a question. And it was the funniest thing because I'm like fourth to go to speak, and people are streaming up the aisles to get ready to go on the cabs to the airport. But then they see that I'm in line, and everybody kind of stopped and waited. It was like a duel. And Flippy's going to talk, and I'm just, like, cracking my knuckles. Like, you know, the 2-3 guys in front of me were basically told by this guy in front of the whole crowd that they were incompetent and they should turn in their license before they left the building and not harm anybody anymore. And they were, like, They like slumped down in the chair and were like almost like ash crestfallen, just like they were just expunged. So he's looking over the lights at anyone else, and I went, "Over here, pal!" And it was like, "Woo, Flippy!" And there were a couple hundred people like just zoom in on me there, and I just said, "Just want to ask you before I go back to the front lines. I practice about 40 minutes from ground zero. And I had a 9-year-old girl turn over on my table a couple of days ago and ask me why God took away her mom and dad. Would that fall into the context of your ethics? Should I call the parish priest from the table? You moron." And it escalated to melee. And then he said that I was practicing psychology without a license. And then I took the microphone off the stand and I said, as I ran down the aisle, "So is every bartender on Bourbon Street," and then took the mic away. But I digress. So I'm saying, how do you get past this boundary where you're discussing the immaterial nature of a human being? You're using the muscles and the ligaments and the tissue and the issues and all that stuff's coming up, all that memory's all locked up in that tension in their body as a neural circuit like you're talking about. Do the clients have to be aware that this is what you're aiming at, to give them basically permission to discuss not just their symptoms, but their perception of themselves in those symptoms, and giving them a language that isn't about talking about labeling all that stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Especially when it comes to spiritual stuff, when you're dealing with death, when you're dealing with what do I do with the rest of my life, the midlife crisis crowd that wanders through me all the time, and you're dealing with special needs families that are lost, that are looking for answers, people that are dealing with chronic and intense uncertainty. And there's a lot of people that'll be doing a lot of caregiving for seniors in their 40s and 50s because people aren't dying. They're being vegetated and pickled till they're 95.
Yeah.
So you're dealing with a lot of existential angst here. That's why the shift from the chair to the table, putting them on the floor and making them move around and feel, is a healthy move, because that's something that the family can practice, not just with the practitioner, but the family itself can learn these mindfulness practices. So how do you shift the theme from sort of like getting people out of their head and out of their story and back into an embodied conversation, if you're going to have these ethics things come up and you can't talk about that stuff, how do you get the politics, you know, out of the room?
Well, I think when clients have an experience of their body, if they have an experience, if they're sort of encouraging them to feel their seat, for example, then they can go with that awareness. They have that experience, so they understand the language of what I'm talking about. I'm not sure if that's answering your question.
Well, you're saying basically that the proof's in the pudding. I could take you to the amusement park, and I could show you the floor plans, and I could show you the lighting, and prove to you that this exists, this structure exists. But if you just get on the roller coaster, you won't have any more questions.
Right. Let's just go there and do that. Yeah.
Yeah. So how do you get people in the tent? Because in somatics, we have to do some type of a Mummenschanz dance to sort of explain to them what it is, because they don't have any reference points, like a new cereal in the aisle.
Oh, grounding technique. I just start off with new clients. I start off with a grounding technique that's body based, and they know that, because when I explain how we talk over things, and they know that that's not going to be helpful if they're going to be talking over their emotions. So that we can, as we go through the session, I can check in, and they can report to me what's going on. That's a far richer experience for them.
Well, directly, this is what we try to teach, the concept of first person authority in our work, and most people are really kind of socially conditioned to have third person authority. Whatever someone told them about themselves, whatever label they got, they internalize it, and then they build a physiology around it. And then that becomes their reference point, and then they build behaviors and an identity up around that label. So to get them to the raw stuff that you're talking about, it just involves a lot of sort of orientation. Because the more you tell them and you can't show them, their ears just close off.
Yes, right. That's right. Absolutely. They have to have the experience. And that's how you know.
Mm-hmm.
When you feel it in your body. When you know anything, when you know it in your gut, you know it, right? So until you have that experience, you don't really know it. It's just like, oh, that's nice. That sounds interesting, but not really getting it. You got to get it in your body. You have to feel it.
Well, yeah, one of the best demonstrations I ever saw of that was back in chiropractic college at one of these summer picnic things. They had three guys up on the stage, and they were going to give the placebo effect, and then one was going to be given shock therapy, and the other one was going to be given so I forget what the word. But basically, they handed one guy a sugar pill. They splashed another guy with water, and then the other guy that they slapped his face, like, snap out of it. And they were basically saying was that that you can't separate mind from body, and basically the placebo effect that had that auto suggestion that this was going to make you feel better. It was 40% of the time it worked, no matter what the pill was. And of course, you know, the hysterical and I'm wet scene from the producers came up with the splashing the water and slapping the guy from Moonstruck. You know, I just think a lot of people take the approach that the body is actually in the way to well-being.
Yeah.
It's an obstacle to be overcome,
not a
support.
I know,
yeah.
It's a huge, huge tool, because you can, when we have an emotion, it shows up in our body. But
mm-hmm.
What's really interesting is that if you change that, if you change your sort of physiology in the moment, you actually can change your emotion. Like you can affect change in the brain. So it goes both ways.
Give your definition of emotional health, because it was a very down-to-earth definition. I loved it, and I want to make T-shirts that say it. So what is that definition you have up there? I go to your site in front of me.
Great. Is that right, eh?
I'll fish it out for you. I'll bail you out here in a minute.
Yeah.
I can just go hit my little gremlin, and it goes right there.
But it's
just something about... about what you said, that I mean, because a lot of people, we talk about emotions in our work on the Somatic Companion, that people don't get angry. Angry gets them. Angry is a physiology that they have to be able to recognize the cues for and contextualize it. And your phrase about it was, I probably should have clipped this before we got here, but the page is opening up slowly. And it's something that I think that if people just had that in their hip pocket, and they could use that as their measure for well-being, it would absolutely shift around the way that they actually used psychology as a support mechanism rather than as a crutch. So here's your definition. It says, what is emotional health? It's measured by your capacity to engage in playful moments. Uh-huh. A healthy nervous system has the flexibility to let go, to release tension without drugs or even without hot baths or meditation, which is hilarious.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean,
yeah, I
most
that.
People don't understand it's that simple.
Yes.
Playful moments. So it's like all work and no play, all that stuff. But what you're talking about here is exactly, paradoxically, what the life coach shapes were talking about without giving anyone direction to get there. They just point. They're sort of like the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz. They just point. Well, the yellow brick road. That's kind of what they tell you, life coaches, every single one of them.
Right.
You know, they don't really walk down the path with you. But how did you come up with that angle?
Well, because it happened to me, I guess, because when my nervous system became more regulated, and that you kind of have to understand what that means, but basically
mm-hmm.
it's more resilient. I can bounce back. I can take in stimulation, and I can let it go. So
right. It's
got that in and out kind of feature.
Less
and,
residual tension, yes.
Yes. And when that happens, then there's a feeling of aliveness.
Mm-hmm.
In the system, you come into it, and you can be in the moment, and you can't. I don't think you can be. I don't think you can play without having that capacity to really be in the moment. And people can be in a moment here, or a moment here, but it's really hard to be present
mm-hmm.
a long period of time, unless you're really developed. I think.
Yeah, in the early developmental circles, they call it neuroception. In some of the industrial psychology circles, they call it your allostasis is good, allostatic load is good, which is like you can handle your mental stress. And in our work, we call it the sense of coherence, which is Antonovsky's work, the SOC, where your life is meaningful, comprehensive, and manageable, and you could actually you feel safe in your environment to move around, which, of course, would ensue play. You don't play when you're feeling threatened. You pray, probably.
Right, when you're feeling safe. And safety is a lot about reducing the amount of activation in the nervous system.
So See, this is what I'm saying. You guys talk nervous system all the time now. You psychologists, they used to just talk mind. Now we're actually into body. Well, maybe in 50 years we'll talk soma. I don't know.
Yeah,
but I'm fascinated with your stuff. Just wanted to kind of wind down here. What do you think from the time somebody clicks on your wonderful homepage and sees the gremlins and stuff, what do you think is the number one misconception your site, your work can clear up for them and maybe offer that to our listeners right now?
Okay. So most people don't realize that therapy isn't just about most people think it's for anxiety and depression, but it's much more. Because once you get rid of anxiety and depression, if you don't have the pathways, that just brings you to neutral. If you want joy, if you want happiness, if you want expansion, if you want to be able to step into your life, you need to expand it. That's how therapy is useful. That's how I'm using it. Expand my life.
Literally stretch your mind by stretching your body, I guess is what you're telling us here.
Yeah,
wow,
basically stretch what I'm able to do, what I'm, what the kind of change I can take on. Like when I started this site, I couldn't even post in a forum. I was just so shaken in my boots, you know, just coming out that way.
Yeah, well, like I said, you've done a fascinating job on that site. We hope to even just approximate it on our world here at Naked Soma, because we're creating a huge lexicon to sort of translate a lot of things for people, and you've done a great job to sort of soften the ramp of people to come into a therapeutic world, because like I said, the stigma's still there. Gotta go to my shrink, I'm screwed up. And sort of the Albert Lewis phenomenon is everybody's neurotic, get over it. It's like, you know, people go to the dentist and no one walks around going, you've got feelings, you know, there's no stigma there.
I told
the woman the other day, I got my butt kicked by my dentist on Monday, and the hygienist comes along, because she's like the evil wizard in there. She goes, what are you in for today? And I pointed to the tooth, and she goes, well, you did tell me you're dentally ill. I said, yes, I'm dentally ill. I'm here for a dental beating. And basically nobody looks at that hygiene as being a stigma, so why couldn't it be mental hygiene? Why couldn't it be hygiene for your emotions? I don't understand that. But
hygiene for your nervous system.
Yeah, neural hygiene.
I like that.
I think the chiropractors have actually used that. But I used that for 10 years, but brother, forget it. Ugh, I go on and on. So, I just think, like I said, there has to be somewhat of a bridge, Charlie, connecting these worlds a little bit more so that a dialogue can go on between the people that are more oriented and more kind of conditioned and trained in the body modalities and the ones that are doing the talking stuff, because, like I said to that SOB down in New Orleans, I said, I don't know about you, but my clients talk to me. You know, I'm not a butcher. They're alive. And it was horrible to say that I couldn't talk about a spiritual concern with the person because I didn't have a degree in comparative religion. It was unethical, actually.
That makes no sense at all. It was just ridiculous.
The man was telling me this with beads around his neck. So, you know, that's the reason why you were a little gun-shy to come out with your message in the beginning, was because there's such a fear, I think, on that political layer in all these professions to kind of keep things stupid and separate.
Separate, yeah.
Yeah, so they can compete and everybody can just go around the Mowbray Bush and play, the game of the pinata game when they have a problem. And they just go, they prove how sick they are and they go bring it all to the lawyer and cash out. You know? Oh, that's sad. Okay, sorry to end on a note like that. All right, so everyone else, if you haven't tuned in at the beginning, this is myshrink.com is the site to go to. And we want to thank you for joining us here at Naked Soma. Everything else you wanted to that you got coming up this fall that you wanted to share with the audience, or?
Oh, we'll be having online events, seminars, teleseminars that people could sign up for.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That starts in September?
Not in September, in the fall sometime. Yeah, I haven't set a date yet. Yeah.
Nice.
All right. Well, thanks, Susan, for joining us. Hopefully, we'll have you on again maybe around the holidays. We can talk about how to get through the holidays or something with you guys, and you can give us some grounding exercises for all the supercharged shoppers here on the East Coast.
Yes.
And have a great fall out there in the beautiful Vancouver, British Columbia. Maybe I get there someday. And we'll talk to you soon here. Have a great time here on Naked Soma. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Susan.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, we have 40 seconds.
the heck did I just say? Have a great time here. What the heck's wrong with me?
Well, you're eco.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of eco.
Oh, yes. So did you...
Here we go. You want to hear what eco really sounds like?
Yeah,
here
if anyone wants to know what eco sounds like, if actually go to nickasoma.com and please read the S-List ebook. But I just want, this is a voicemail from one of my clients. Go ahead.
Hey, Mark, it's me. I'm down here in the parking lot. I guess it's about 1:30. I guess you're not coming. I guess I screwed up. So I guess I'll talk to you during the week. Give me a ring at my house and stuff. I got to start putting the stuff on the calendar. Oh, my God, look at that ad.
And on that note...
God.
I will say travel light.
You filthy criminies.
See you next week.
Bye.